epistle reading from 1 John chapter 4. Beloved, let us love one another because love is of God. Everyone who loves is begotten of God and knows God. Those who do not love have known nothing of God, for God is love. And love will come to perfection in us when we can face the day of judgment without fear, because our relation to this world is just like Christ's. There is no fear in love, for perfect love drives out fear, and anyone who is afraid is still imperfect in love. Do you remember that song? I remember it from my parents playing it. I think the version of that song that was most popular was done by the Youngbloods in an album that was put out in 1969, the year that I was born. Okay, so I'm dated. Just for fun, I thought to myself about those lyrics this week. Come on, people, now, smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. What in the world were they thinking in 1969? And what was happening back then? I did a little research, and I found out that there were some interesting things that happened in my year of birth, in addition to Woodstock. The first human set foot on the moon, and the debut of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Was accompanied also by a lot of unrest. I found out that the superpowers, the United States and the USSR and China, all performed multiple nuclear weapons tests that year, that Nixon vowed that he would end the war in Vietnam early in the year, and troop withdrawals did begin very slowly during the summer of that year. But by the end of the year, thousands of people had grown impatient, and millions participated in a general strike two different times and protested in the Vietnam moratorium days in October and November. The Stonewall riots happened in New York City. Police launched a surprise attack on the Black Panthers in LA, provoking much disquiet. John Lennon and Yoko Ono released their War Is Over, Happy Christmas single posters, again 2 days before the U.S. conducted a huge nuclear test out in Nevada. And there were race riots in Hartford, Connecticut, and Cairo, Illinois, and York, Pennsylvania, and Cleveland, Ohio, and Camden, New Jersey, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and Jacksonville, Florida. And right here in Columbus, Ohio, on July 21st, 1969, a 69-year-old white man, David Chestnut, shot a 27-year-old black man, Roy Beasley. When Beasley, who had been renting from Chestnut, tried to confront Chestnut about Chestnut striking one of his children, after he was shot, Chestnut's store went up in flames, as did 35 or 40 other buildings in and around that area. The National Guard was called in, 200 people were arrested, one person died. And in a story too familiar to our ears, Chestnut was acquitted for Beasley's murder. Freddie Gray, Walter Scott, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, John Crawford, Jonathan Farrell, Jordan Davis, Trayvon Martin, Emmett Till. We hear those names from our time. But the question this week, when I continued to hear the news, was how do we stitch together past and present and think of ourselves as having experienced progress? This is a difficult question, and maybe even a more important question is the question, why is it when we hear words like Come on, people, now. Love your brother. Let's love one another. That those words fall sometimes extraordinarily flat on our ears. At least they fall extraordinarily flat on my ears. After 45 years of so-called progress. And yet, what does today's text from the gospel say? It sounds kind of like a song from the 60s in one way. Beloved, let us love one another. For God is love. And there is no fear in love. Perfect love drives out fear. And if you listen to the rest of that Youngblood song from 1969, it says, love is but a song we sing, fear the way we die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Come on, people, now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another. And I wonder sometimes if love is but a song we sing, isn't there a kind of an inadequacy that's implied in that phrase, love is but a song we sing? Let's all just love one another. Has that really worked for the past 45 years? Is it a problem with love, or is it a problem with us? And when we're talking about love, what are we talking about? Maybe the way most people thought about love in 1969, and my guess is probably even today, was kind of as a sentimental song we sing, an uncontrollable, surging feeling of positive emotion. And if so, then no. Clearly, everybody get together now, just love one another, is not going to be an answer to our problems. We can't love people, given that definition of love, in anything but a very vague, generalized way, and temporary. But what if love is something else? What if love is, as the poets say, a many-splendored thing? I was reading a book in the Andover Newton class I was taking just a couple weeks ago called Positivity. It's grounded in the science of positive psychology, which has flourished in the last 15 years. They've run thousands of studies across the country in the last 15 years trying to figure out what makes people happy. Positive psychology was birthed out of the idea that psychology for a long time has been content to take people from a negative 5 to a negative 3 to make them a little bit less unhappy. But what if we could marshal the resources of science to actually figure out how people can go from a 0 to a positive 5? What is it that makes people happy? And what they realized is that there's a lot of thought that's been put into how negative emotions have evolved over time. We use negative emotions like anger and fear as self-protection mechanisms. But why did positive emotions evolve over time? What was the purpose of that? And what they've discovered, what they've proposed as a theory, is that positive emotions broaden and build us. They broaden our social relationship. When I feel gratitude, when I feel appreciation for a person, when I practice honesty, my social connections expand. And as my social connections expand, my resources expand because I have people supporting me when I'm in trouble. They also build psychological resources for us so that in times of despair, we can look back to positive experiences and say, I was carried through. Wow, I can do this. Positive emotions broaden us and they build us. And what these scientists are finding out is that love is not just one of the core emotions. Seligman points out that if you look at any religious tradition across the world, and even non-religious ethical traditions across the world, you'll find that there are 6 core values that are part of all of them. Honesty, gratitude, serenity, temperance, awe. These things connect people everywhere. But it's interesting that Barbara Fredrickson, in her book Positivity, says, what does love fit into this? Love is what happens when any one of those or any mixture of those positive emotions comes together in a connection with another person that draws us in. It's a surge of any kind of positive emotion or mix of that draws us together and connects us. So she says, kind of like the poet, love is a many splendored thing. And in our Christian tradition, when I read that, I thought, this is exactly like the Christian tradition, isn't it? That grows out of the Jewish tradition that says, if you don't have the basic virtues, you can't really fully embody love. Love is a flower made of many petals, and you only get the full bloom when you have all the petals, when you have honesty and patience and gratitude and temperance and serenity and awe and all the other fruits of the Spirit, we would call them, or component virtues of love or qualities of love that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Every single one of those contributes to the whole thing. So really, to love one another means to be feeling and experiencing all of the component virtues that create the big thing of love. And one of those virtues is honesty. It occurs in every single religious tradition around the world. We value honesty. And when I think about the words, we need to love one another, I think about the need for honesty. Because there's been a lot of stuff going on about through Facebook, social media, emails this week. If you listen to Fox News, you'll see a kind of a take on what happened in Baltimore that's a little bit disturbing. Like, why are these people doing the wrong thing? They ought to just treat each other right. Wasn't it a great thing that mother pulled her son away from those riots? And we need more mothers to be mothers in Baltimore. When I read that, I thought, a response to a tragedy like Baltimore in that way is saying to ourselves, we really don't need honesty in order to respond rightly into this situation. Because if we were going to respond honestly to what's happening in Baltimore, if we're really going to love our brothers and sisters in Baltimore, we have to be honest. We have to see reality for what it is. We have to be honest with the fact that studies have shown that if, when thousands of resumes are sent out, identical resumes to employers, one with a name that sounds like it's a white person and one with a name that sounds like it's a black person, 50% of the time, the black person's sounding name resume will be dropped. Is that 50%? No, they're 50% less likely to be interviewed. The fact of the matter is that on average, black people in this country are charged, and this is an interesting statistic, $700 more when they go to purchase an identical used car that a white person purchased somewhere. The fact is that nationally, black people are twice as likely to be pulled over by the police officers. And that's nationally, not in particular neighborhoods where the rate might be higher. And even though marijuana use is identical between black people and white people, blacks are four times as likely to be arrested in the United States. And as we know, the incarceration rate is wildly disproportionate to the population of black people to white people in America. So to be honest with ourselves about the background of what happens when communities show up with voice to protest what they consider police brutality, we have to understand the whole picture. If we're really going to love people, we have to be honest about what that whole picture is. Part of that picture is that we live in a society with largely unconscious racial prejudice that affects people's lives every single day. Another reality is we have to understand that there are systemic injustices in our system that cause people to be upset. If you, and this is not just a problem of people who are black, nor is it a problem just of people who are Hispanic. It's a problem of anybody who has had to suffer through persistent poverty. We live in a culture, as you know, in which there are not enough jobs that pay a living wage and that have benefits to employ all the employable people in our country. They just do not exist. We live in a country where thousands of people live in areas where they cannot afford, with the number of jobs that are available to them, clean, sanitary housing that's kept up in good condition. We live in a country where the school system sets people up to fail, and where there is structural injustice in the school system. And this may rub a little few feathers today, but I think we're talking about honesty here, right? We can't love our brother unless we're honest about the situation. And this struck me when I came back from Japan. Just a few more minutes, I'll be done, I promise you. But when you come from a country like Japan to America and you see the way the school system is set up here, you realize how very detrimental this is to so many people. We fund our school system by property taxes. And so what that does is it allows people who want better schools to raise the taxes in their neighborhood to increase the quality of those schools. When they increase their taxes and increase the quality of schools, they increase their land values. That prices people out who are economically in a different situation, and you end up with an economically gated community. And what we have now in the United States is an even more difficult situation where the state decides that wants to equilibrate this. So they set up a state funding formula that says a community like New Albany or Granville or Westerville that has a higher per capita income should be able to raise more money by levies, and so we're going to give you less funding. And so when the state gives less funding, then the communities have to raise taxes again in order to keep the same amount of funding. And what it does is it drives a wedge between higher income neighborhoods and lower income neighborhoods that actually drives it them further and further apart to now where we have very ghettoized neighborhoods with people who are not diverse sometimes. Economically, they're not diverse anymore. And this sets up communities where people are really feel disenfranchised. Do we really believe that if you took even 1 out of 10 people who live in an impoverished West Columbus neighborhood and gave them a typical house in Granville, that they could pay for the taxes and the insurance on a house here? They couldn't do it. And so we have a structural system that keeps people in poverty. And we can't say we love our brother unless we're honest about the realities of this system that keep people in poverty. A system which sends good jobs overseas and rewards companies sometimes even for doing that, that takes education access away from people. And we wonder why people get upset. Bonhoeffer said, "A love which violates or even which merely neutralizes the truth is an accursed love, even though it may present itself in the most pious of dress." And William Sloane Coffin said, "Truth is always in danger of being sacrificed on the altars of good taste or of personal comfort or of social stability." And Martin Luther King, in a collection of sermons called Strength to Love, quoted a poet, "For sweetest things turn sour by their deeds. Lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds." Love is not a bouquet of festering lilies. Love is a flower only fully blooming when the petal of truth unfolds within it. And love is only a full blossom when it contains all the component virtues of love. And if we don't have, you know this in your relationships, personal relationships, right? If you don't have honesty in that relationship, you don't have love. And if you don't have courage, you don't have full love. And if you don't have generosity, you don't have the fullness of love. And if you don't have justice, you don't have the fullness of love. And if you can't exercise a little patience, you don't have the fullness of love. And if you don't show gratitude, if you can't see the good and the potential and be aware of the fundamental spaciousness of the world and the possibilities for innovation and renewal that are before us, you don't have the fullness of love. Love is a flower that blooms full. And it's only in that way that we can really say, come on people now, love one another. Let's all get together and make this a better world. Because only when we understand love that way does love become a solid rock, a kind of rock of ages on which we can build ourselves and our society. When we understand love as the pure good, when we can see things as they are, as the arc of the universe, and when we can live within that, with that, and for that, And when we can live that way, with that kind of love, then all fear is gone. This is our way. And may we not forget that. Let's pray. You are love. May we live within you. May we not forget you. May we not forget ourselves. And may all beings be well in your care.